Quaker.com podcast. Today is Wednesday, May 30th, 2012. My name is Ben Stone, and this is podcast number 153. And I should apologize for the last episode. That was Monday. Monday's podcast, I had the sound set wrong. So hopefully we've got that taken care of for today. Let's see. Oh, and I should give an apology for yesterday for not giving a podcast for Tuesday. This is again, I'm not trying to, if you've heard me talk about these things before, I'm not trying to get sympathy. I'm just making an excuse. I had what really seriously can be called a mental health day yesterday. If you've listened to my podcasts, long enough, you know that I have had in excess of 35 concussions in my lifetime. And so as a result of that, I have brain injuries that sometimes are quite debilitating. And normally, I would say, you know, like 90% of the time, I'm still functional in every way. But some days, just like yesterday, I it's almost like I can't wake up. I just walk around partially non-functional for hours and hours at a time. Sometimes I can take a nap and that will snap me out of it. Other times it just has to work its way out. But yesterday was like that. I tried several times to sit down and put a podcast together and I didn't have the clarity of mind to do it. So I had to just give up on the process. Now, I mentioned in Monday's podcast that we always have it thrown at us that our anarchy has never been tried and it's never worked. And I mentioned in that podcast that, you know, at what point does this myth, when people repeat this over and over and over and people tolerate the repeating of this myth over and over, at what point does that myth become a lie? I mean, when the preponderance of evidence becomes so great that it almost gets silly to say something, anything, whatever the myth might be, at what point does the myth become a lie? And I used the example Monday of a person climbing a mountain to go up and see the gods that live on top of a mountain. And this is where the myth teller says, the gods live on top of the mountain. So the skeptic goes up there and looks around. He doesn't see any gods, and he comes back down. He's like, I was up there. There's no gods. And so the myth teller says, well, the gods are only there when the clouds are there, only when there's cloud cover, when you see clouds on top of the mountain, covering the tops of the mountain, that's when you know the gods are there. So the guy goes up and spends like 2 months in all kinds of weather, and he comes back down. He's like, there are no gods on the top of that mountain. And so the myth teller will adjust the story again, and he'll say something like, well, you didn't see him because you don't believe him. Or maybe, you know, oh, well, they were busy for the last 2 months because, you know, this or that or whatever. Each time the myth teller will adjust the myth to compensate for the truth that he's facing at that particular moment. But he'll never give up the myth that the gods live on the mountain. And it doesn't matter what kind of evidence is presented. And that's what we face with this myth that anarchy has never existed, it's never been tried, it's never worked, or whatever variation that you hear. There are so many examples that you can point to. The thing I used to say all the time, I haven't talked about this in a while, but the thing that I used to say all the time is that really and truly history, when we normally think of history, history is the writing down of the record of events that went on. But really and truly, history is simply propaganda of the state. It's a recording of great leaders of the state. It's a recording of their deeds and their lives and the things that were important to them. But history is not really the recording of the average people that live their lives and do stuff. It's just not that. It's a recording of great wars. It's a recording of notable leaders, almost all state-based leaders. It's a glorification of those statists and of their lives and of the wars that they fought. It's to a certain extent, it's a glorification of religious leaders in so much, and there are exceptions, but in so much as those religious leaders interact with the state, it's a recording of the. You don't have a lot of history of monks that were off in a. You know, 300-400 years of monks in a monastery somewhere. They're not writing down. You know, today I washed my feet. That's not history. History is a recording of the events of the state. And so, if you don't have a state, you really don't have any history. And that's the situation that we face when we look back at what is called history. We see a recording of the events of the Roman Empire. We see a recording of the events of the Greek city-states or of Egypt. Or, you know, we see the recording of the great deeds of these state leaders and their wars and all their accomplishments. But we don't see the vast spans where civilized people lived for eons of time with no state. Because there's nothing to write down. You don't have any great leader, of course, because you don't have a state. You don't have any great accomplishments like building giant pyramids for no purpose whatsoever. You don't have things like that happening. Well, I shouldn't say no purpose. It's for the glorification of the state and the glorification of the state leaders. You don't have these things happening in a stateless society because there is no state to glorify, and there are no state leaders to glorify. And there are no vast wars to bring glory to a leader. So if there's no recording of the wars and there's no recording of the leader, there's no recording of the state, there's no history. So for that reason, when you look across Russia, there's no history in that sense all the way up until, you know, until the Mongol hordes began riding across and bringing their version of the state. Or little pockets of where the state appeared here or there on a river or something like this. The same thing goes with all of Northern Europe. There's no real history, there's no written record in history in Northern Europe until Rome starts to infect the area, and then you have a certain amount of written history regarding Rome. But outside of the borders of Rome, it's almost like nothing at all was happening. Well, that's not true. A lot of things were happening. They just weren't happening under the control of a state. The people were stateless, and therefore there was no reason to write down silly events that happen on a day-to-day basis. Who records a history? You know, today I milked the cow. Yesterday I traded with Farmer McKay, and we, you know, we exchanged a pig and a goat. You don't write things like this down because peaceful people living their lives don't make history. They just live their lives. James C. Scott, I used to talk about him all the time. His book, The Art of Not Being Governed, I used to talk about that all the time on the podcast, and I should probably bring it back up and talk about it again. Maybe even, you know, go through a couple of the chapters or something at some point in time. But this is a great book. It's called The Art of Not Being Governed. The subtitle is An Anarchist History of Upland Southeast Asia. And again, the author is James C. Scott. It's printed from Yale University Press. So this is, you know, it's a major anthropological and historical study of the people of Southeast Asia, what James C. Scott calls the Zoma people. But it's not just about them. It's really about the anarcho culture that has existed throughout time, anywhere where there was no state. And James C. Scott really does a good job in breaking this down, the difference between state cultures and non-state cultures. And he uses the Zoma people in Southeastern Asia as an example because they have existed during our lifetime. They are very rapidly being exterminated, either openly being killed by states, or they're being just, in a sense, engulfed and devoured by the state, pulled into the state in one form or another. But up until really the last 50 years or so, the Zoma people have existed as free anarchist people throughout upland Southeast Asia. And the state had no ability to go in there and mess with them or conquer them or anything. They had a very unique life, very unique lifestyle that they adapted in order to be invisible to the state. And again, James C. Scott goes into a lot of different cultures. He doesn't just talk about Southeast Asia in that book, but oh, I'll tell you what, Jeff Riggenbach did a thing for the Mises Institute. Maybe I can find a link to that, I'll try to find a link to Jeff Riggenbach's thing on this book, on James C. Scott's book. He did an article on it, and it's one of the Mises Institute's in their series on, I'm stalling as I try to remember what Jeff Riggenbach's series was. He recorded a whole series of podcasts for the Mises Institute, and he did a podcast reviewing that book. It's a really good book. That's how I heard of it first. This was back like, probably 2009 or early 2010. Maybe it was later than that. Maybe it was later in 2010 when Jeff Riggenbach did the review of it, and I immediately got my hands on it. I wanted to see this thing. Anyway, really good book. I'm not making anything off of plugging it, but, and you know, this is a good opportunity to mention that. I don't make anything off these podcasts. And I don't intend to ever earn, you know, or take any kind of wages from these podcasts. We haven't had the donate button up on the website now for like 6 months or something, 5 months, whatever it was. When we did have the donate button up, it was strictly to produce enough funding to, you know, to renew the website and the costs and so forth, and we in addition to that, we came up with enough funding to buy new microphones and some new equipment and everything, but there's no money being produced by badquaker.com that's going into anyone's pocket at this point. Now, at some point, maybe after we get the website, once the renovations take place and the website is more functional and everything, it may be necessary for us to employ like one person as a administrator of the website. So that's possible. That may take place, but that won't be me. I don't foresee in any way me ever taking any kind of salary or money for doing these podcasts, because for me, the purpose in doing these podcasts is to share my thoughts and my feelings with people. It's not to try to put money in my pocket. Now, that, again, that's not to say that we're not trying to make the thing so that it's self-supportive. We are. That's our arrangement with sponsors and the commercials that you hear. Those don't actually produce any money. I very strongly believe in the Shire Silver that we do the commercial for. I believe in what they're doing. And so we've been giving them free advertising now for months. And the Survival Gear Bags, we don't make any money off of that either. Kelly is my friend, and it's my intention to try to help him, you know, with his business. Now, he has, I've gotten free stuff from him. I did a review on the knife and everything. But as far as money goes, you know, none of those advertisements or anything actually bring money to us. So I just wanted to clarify that. Not that there's anything wrong with earning money. Of course, there's nothing wrong with earning money. But that's not why I'm here, and that's not why I'm talking into this microphone. Okay, boy, that was wandering from the topic, wasn't it? To go from anarchist societies and James C. Scott's The Art of Not Being Governed to making money on podcasts, that's quite a journey there. But really, yeah, I we don't make any money or anything. I'm not, I don't get any kickback for saying go buy this book, but honestly, if you want a book that goes into detail of anarchist societies that have functioned for thousands of years, this is a good book. The Art of Not Being Governed. There is a problem with it, and I don't know how to say this in a polite way. James C. Scott, I wouldn't call him a good... I wouldn't call him a good writer. I would call him a great researcher, and I would call him detailed. I would use words like that to describe his writings, but it's not the kind of gripping stuff that's going to hold your attention. And you know, it's real, almost clinical. His treatment of the Zoma people and anarchical societies. So it's not, you know, it's not Stephen King snappy, have fun reading it. This is somewhat hard reading. It's, for me, it's like reading Mises. You have to just chew it and really chew it and chew it and swallow it. It's more of an effort for me to read that stuff. But it's important, and therefore, you know, I have to read it. Anyway, so if you buy it, The Art of Not Being Governed by James C. Scott, and you start reading it and you're like, man, this is dry. I warned you, but it's important. I wish it were written more like, what is that guy's name? Jared Diamond. Is that his name? Yeah. Jared Diamond. I wish it, you know, Jared Diamond is also a historian and a writer and so forth. He wrote the book Guns, Germs, and Steel, which is, in ways, it's a lot like The Art of Not Being Governed, except Jared Diamond is wrong. Jared Diamond's writing style is very captivating, and he's able to go through a lot of information and bring it to you in a way that it's really easy to absorb it and it's really easy to hold on to it. It's just that his conclusions are all wrong. His information is wonderful, and his information is very factual, and I very much enjoy reading Jared Diamond's stuff, including I really loved his book Guns, Germs, and Steel. But it's wrong. It's just dead wrong on so many things that it's really hard to sort through it and enjoy it, considering how, you know, he's coming at it from a really hardline statist point of view, and it's really hard to digest it and not scream at the book as you're reading it. So if James C. Scott had the writing talent of Jared Diamond, then... you would have a killer book. You would have an earth-shattering book, you might say. Or if Jared Diamond had if Jared Diamond wasn't dyed-in-the-wool statist, and then he could look at these things objectively and he could see, you know, the flaws in his theories, then you could get some tremendous books. But having to either sort through the nonsense that Jared Diamond spews out, or having to sort through the stiff, dry writing of James C. Scott, you know, if there was a balance somewhere. Anyway, so I talked way too long about that. But, The Art of Not Being Governed, if you can at all tolerate the dry reading of it, it's really great. And I'll try to remember to put a link to Jeff Riggenbach's review on that. I'll have to dig it up over at the Mises Institute. Now, one of the things that the James C. Scott talks about lightly in that book is the how Hill people in general have tended to reject the state, and how hiding in mountains typically was a very successful way to avoid a state. And one of the examples that he uses is the people of Appalachia. I'm doing a little segue here. I'm trying to be smooth and radio-like as I do this. But I wanted to talking about James C. Scott and his The Art of Not Being Governed, I wanted to link that to something that's going on right now. The History Channel has this show on about the Hatfields and the McCoys. And it has, what's his name? The big-time star, Kevin Costner. And, you know, he doesn't do a bad job in it. I've watched a couple episodes of it now, and I don't really know the whole story of the Hatfields and the McCoys. I you know, I've never really gone into that to the depth that I probably should have if I was going to comment on the actual story of the Hatfields and McCoys. So I don't know how accurate this History Channel depiction is of them or the story of their feud. I know in the past almost everything that comes out of the mainstream media and or Hollywood in regards to Appalachia, the Appalachian clans, the Hatfields and McCoys specifically, or any feuds like that, typically everything that the mainstream media or Hollywood has ever produced about those things is complete and utter nonsense. So I really did not have high hopes at all that the History Channel would treat the Appalachian people with any level of respect. And in that sense, I'm a little surprised and a little pleased that they are not really portraying the Appalachian people in this miniseries as being complete backwards idiots, and they're tending to stay away from a lot of the negative stereotyping that you see out of Hollywood. So I was very pleased in that. Now, there are things in this TV show, in this Hatfields and McCoys TV show, there are things that kind of irritate me, but they're what you might call Appalachian geek things. Like, for instance, when they show the really nice log cabin that the wealthier of the two families has, and I look at the end joints on the cabin and how the cabin is constructed, and I think, no, that's not Appalachian construction. That's what came from the Germans up in the Minnesota and places like that, where the building a log cabin was almost like an art form to those German immigrants. The Appalachians did not use those types of joints and that type of construction. But see, that's Appalachian geek stuff. Another thing that bothered me was there was, in one of the episodes, three of the members of one of the family are killed, and so they have a funeral, and they have the three graves dug, and it shows all the family gathered around and everything, and the whole scene lacks all of the elements that you would see in an Appalachian funeral, especially in an Appalachian graveside ceremony. It lacks all of the real the flavor that you would get from an actual Appalachian graveside ceremony, and that's a detail that maybe you say, well, that's just Appalachian geek. I'm just being picky. Well, yeah, I know, but that's the kind of a thing that if you had spent a little time researching it, it wouldn't have been that hard to replicate, and it would have given it a real, genuine Appalachian flavor if you had made the graveside service more Appalachian. The next thing is that they had the graveyard displayed or depicted in the show as being in what you would call a bottom, or in flatland, in a meadow down in a basically part of a floodplain of a creek. Well, you don't in Appalachia, especially in the old days. Now, if you're around one of the big cities, then this is different. But among the hill people, you do not have a graveyard in bottomland. First off, you don't waste bottomland in Appalachia is extremely valuable. That's where you have all your growing is done in bottomland. That's where the ground is rich. It's sediments from the rivers and the creeks and so forth. So you have all your growing in the bottomlands. You have your graveyards up on the tops of mountains, and you do that for several reasons. One is because you don't want to waste bottomland with a graveyard. A second is there can be nasty floods in Appalachia at times, and if you have your dead buried in bottomland, you're going to have corpses floating down the creek, and that is not a pleasant thing. So you just don't bury in bottomlands. On top of that, if you want an eternal resting place for someone you love, you don't stick them down in a hollow. You put them up on top of a mountain. And that way, when you go and visit that grave, you can look out and see the beauty of the Appalachians. You can't see the beauty of the Appalachians from down in a hollow in bottomland. So, you know, that kind of detail kind of sticks in my craw as I watch the show. And again, this is all just, you know, Appalachian geek stuff, and I shouldn't let it bug me. But it's little details like that that give a genuineness to a show that, you know, it would have taken so little for them to understand these things and to do it right. And it would have added so much depth and so much flavor to the show, rather than giving it more of a Western type feel, which it does. The Hatfields and McCoys on the History Channel has a Western feel, and that's what's wrong with it when I watch it. It just doesn't feel like Appalachia. It feels like it could be happening in, you know, in any of the mountain country out west, in Colorado or in Montana or, you know, Idaho. It could be happening in any of those places, because the culture they're displaying is a lot more Western than it is Appalachian. The accents are correct, but most of the accents in the show are not correct. And again, you could have just hired an Appalachian language coach, and he could have helped you out with that. In the comedy movie Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, which was not set in Appalachia, it was set in the South. One of the beauties of that silly comedy was that there were very careful uses of Southern accents to change from one group to another group, and you saw the culture shift as the movie was depicting different people from different areas of the South in that movie. And if they had taken the time to do that with Hatfields and McCoys and inject some of that Appalachian culture, rather than just assuming that all Southerners are the same and all, you know, all hillbillies are hillbillies, or, you know, all rednecks are just rednecks. If you get away from that kind of thinking, Southern accents specifically, and, you know, technically West Virginia is not the South. It's just not. It wasn't even divided. Well, that's a history lesson. We're not going to go into that. So anyway, so that's my criticism. It's not so much in the substance of the show. I'm really actually enjoying the show a lot more than I thought I would. I normally don't watch much TV, but I'm actually enjoying it more than I really thought that I would. But it would be so much better if they had just taken a little bit of time and a little bit of effort and got to know the actual Appalachian, the sound and the look and the feel of Appalachia. It really would have helped a lot, but they didn't do that. They saved, you know, $100,000 for two salaries or whatever, and rather than doing it right and, you know, getting the sound right and getting the look and the feel right. Well, we all make economic choices every day in our lives, and that was either out of ignorance or out of economics, they made the choice not to get that right feeling in the show. But okay, so we're going to have a break here, head out to the commercial, and I'll be back in about 2 minutes. How would you like to support badquaker.com and get something nice for yourself at the same time? I want to tell you about Survival Gear Bags. It's run by my friend Kelly, who believes in and adheres to the non-aggression principle. Kelly's customers know him for his great customer service and his personal touch, because Kelly handles all customer service himself. The main focus of Survival Gear Bags is to allow you to build your own custom emergency kits with quality gear. Now, I know this because I bought my bug out bag from Survival Gear Bags over 2 years ago, and I've gone all over the country with it by my side. And you can rest assured that the prices will always be the best they can be at Survival Gear Bags. And if you use the link from badquaker.com, they'll probably throw in something for free for you with your order. Now, how do you do this? Well, it's simple. You go to badquaker.com. On the right side of the page, click on the picture of the backpack. Then look around at Survival Gear Bags and find the stuff you want. You'll help badquaker.com, and you'll support a merchant that's one of us. Now, I want to tell you about another way you can support badquaker.com and get something really cool at the same time. Shire Silver. Shire Silver is the proud seller of silver and gold trade cards. Shire Silver believes that silver and gold trade cards will show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. So what are silver and gold trade cards? There are specific weights of gold and silver laminated inside credit card-sized tradable cards. They're a handy and affordable way to trade precious metals. These cards received nationwide recognition when they were widely used as barter at the New Hampshire Porcupine Festival. You want a beer and a hot dog? Hand them a Shire Silver 5 card and get a Shire Silver 1 spot back as change. So again, what do? Well, you go to badquaker.com. On the right side, just below the backpack, you'll see the Shire Silver trade cards. Click on those cards and then check out Shire Silver's site. Be sure and watch Ron's video that's right there on the main page. And then swap some of those ridiculous Federal Reserve notes for something of real value. Something you can keep, trade, or give as the coolest gift ever. But be sure and use the link from badquaker.com. Thanks, folks. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the break. And I'm back. Just to follow up something I didn't mention or I didn't clarify, the reason that I brought up talking about the History Channel's show Hatfields and McCoys, the reason I brought that up is because one of the problems, one of the reasons why that particular feud got out of control, and again, I don't know a lot about the details of the feud. I know a fairly good overview. But that's, you know, that's not really my point. What happened, what you see in that TV show, or what you read about if you go into depth on it, is a display of the worst possible scenario in a Klan feud. And this is very rare and almost unheard of in Appalachia or in other places where Klan, because keep in mind, a Klan society is an anarchist society. All the relationships involved in a Klan society are entirely voluntary. The superstructure of the Klan itself is entirely voluntary, and the leadership of the Klan is voluntary, both as far as the leaders themselves volunteer for that position, and the people who accept their leadership do so voluntarily, and there is no taxation. So when you have voluntary leadership and you have no taxation, you have anarchy. So the people of Appalachia was an anarchist society for over 100 years there, primarily. In the early 1800s, the state began more and more and more to infiltrate Appalachia. By the mid-1800s, by near the War Between the States, the state itself, the government, the state being the idea of aggression-based government, and the government itself had infiltrated to a large extent into Appalachia by the mid-1800s, and certainly by the War Between the States. So what you're seeing in this feud between the Hatfields and the McCoys could not have taken place without the interference of the state. And if you're watching that TV series, you'll notice the role that that law has had in the Hatfields and the McCoys. You had people on the Kentucky side of the Big Sandy that were obeying the law, and you have people on the West Virginia side of the Big Sandy obeying the law, and the law was on the side of the Hatfields, and the law was on the side of the McCoys, and that law being the authority of the states, of the two states involved, Kentucky and West Virginia, that law distorted the traditional Klan position and allowed things like the retribution murders that took place and the escalation of violence that took place. If there had been no state authority, they would have been forced by necessity to figure out a solution to this that didn't involve shooting each other all the time. And that's typically what clans do. On a rare occasion, two clans will clash, or there'll be a clash within a clan and some kind of a split or whatever. But these incidences are rare. And when they do, and when the worst happens, and it comes to a blood feud, and there are actually is killing that goes on, keep in mind when you compare it to the state, when states do things like this, millions of people die. When two clans clash, you very rarely have a blood feud. But when you do, when there actually is a blood feud, it's almost always restricted to a very small pocket of active players in that feud. Rarely is there any collateral damage to society or to the rest of the clan, and certainly not other clans. It's a very rare thing that you get multiple clans, more than two, that is, involved in any kind of a feud in these anarchist societies. And this goes, whether we're talking about Southeast Asia, whether we're talking about, you know, archaic Scotland, whether we're talking about anarchist Ireland, which, you know, for thousands of years up until the English invasion, Ireland existed in that way. And there were clan disputes throughout Ireland, but they never turned into mass war. Because the clan system itself purges that and provides mechanisms. I was talking about Jeff Rickenbach earlier. He did a reading of a Murray Rothbard thing on anarchist Ireland, and I had that on the website. It's still there, but it's hidden away in the archives now. I should probably dig that up or at least put a link to it. Jeff Rickenbach's reading of Murray Rothbard on that topic. But anyway, I wanted to clarify that the reason that the Hatfield and McCoy feud escalated into what it did was because they both had the state law on each of their sides interfering, preventing clan law from taking over and preventing traditional clan law from applying. It gave them excuses to escalate the violence worse and worse, and it gave excuses for exterior people who had no business in the clan war of coming in and being involved in it. So let's get away from that. I did want to go back to the Greenbacker thing very briefly, because I spoke with one person on the phone, and then I had a couple of email exchanges in reference to this, and a little chatting on the side as well, text chatting on the side as well, in reference to things that Ron Paul has said that made people believe that Ron Paul actually was a Greenbacker. And it's very confusing. It's going to take some effort on my part to really sort this out and find out the truth. But from what people are telling me, it's quite possible that Ron Paul either has dabbled, either he has, let's put it this way, you know, ultimately Ron Paul is a politician, and politicians know how to speak in a way so that when they're talking to, let's say the politicians are talking to the Knights of Columbus, a meeting of the Knights of Columbus, they sound very pro-Knights of Columbus, but when they're talking to the VFW, they sound very pro-VFW. And politicians have a tendency to know how to do that almost without thinking. And so Ron Paul, however much you may love him, or, you know, the fact that he spent years as a doctor, or whatever you want to say about him, ultimately he's still a politician. And ultimately, he is skilled at saying things in a way that can be taken in more than one direction. So it's possible that Ron Paul has knowingly spoke to Greenbacker or people who tended towards being Greenbackers, and he used his talk about the Constitution and the Congress's legal constitutional authority to coin money and to regulate money. Of course, now, The Constitution means nothing to me, because the government itself has already violated it to the point of where it's completely useless. But the Constitution, when it was written, and the references to coining money and controlling money, those were not references to actually printing fiat money and controlling the, you know, manipulating the value of money or this money supply. That's not what that was in reference to. And that can easily be shown by, you know, vast amounts of documentation from the writers and the framers of the Constitution that did not want or could not tolerate central banking and or fiat money production. The Constitution was worded so poorly when it was written that it left open the possibility of central banking and fiat money. And that's one of my objections to the Constitution, is that it was a series of compromises in negotiations between hardcore statists and more libertarian-leaning people. And therefore, it really... It really was a flawed document in that sense, that it didn't clarify and it left it in vague terms. But what they were talking about is coining money is not fiat money. It's, if you're coining money, you're actually making money out of something. So you would coin things like copper into pennies. Well, copper is a commodity. You coined, up until 1964 or whatever it was, they actually used silver. Up until 1930-something, they used gold. So clearly, when the writers and the framers of the Constitution were talking about coining money, they were talking about real commodity money. And when they were talking about regulating it, they were talking about making sure that the weights of that money were correct, not what the money supply is or who issues fiat money or things like that. So back to Ron Paul, if he said things or if he has said things that infer that Congress should be printing fiat money, then I can't help but to believe that he was doing so pandering to the Greenbacker crowd. Knowing Ron Paul's knowledge of Austrian economics, I would say that he can't be honest and be a Greenbacker and say the things he said about Austrian economics. He's far too knowledgeable on Austrian economics to make that kind of mistake. So if Ron Paul, and if somebody can show me, if somebody can link to it or whatever, email me or send it to me in whatever way, some area where Ron Paul has talked about fiat money in any kind of a positive fashion or said anything that's more clearly related to the Greenbacker money handling, if somebody can send that to me, I'd really appreciate it, because I'd love to go into that further. But I really think that either words that he said were twisted by the Greenbackers, and they used him to sell their money schemes, or he was intentionally pandering to Greenbackers, one or the other, and I don't know which. I'd love to be able to clarify that. So anybody that has a link to something that Ron Paul has said supporting fiat money, I'd sure love to hear it. And once again, let me define Greenbackers for you just one more time. Well, I say one more time, the fact that these Greenbackers just keep expanding and pushing into libertarian circles means I'm probably going to have to just keep bringing this up over and over and over, because they just keep coming back over and over and over. Even using imagery and so forth, like one of their movies, they used Peter Schiff. Peter Schiff is not at all a Greenbacker, and I don't know why he agreed to let them use a little clip of an interview of his, but in one of their movies, they used Peter Schiff and twisted what he said out of context to make it look like he was supporting the Greenbackers. But anyway, so what is a Greenbacker? Okay, a Greenbacker wants the federal government to either, as a government bank in true social banking, socialized banking, they either want the government to socialize a central bank and the government own the central bank and from that central bank issue fiat money, therefore paying all the government's bills using fiat money. They either want that or they want it to come straight out of the Treasury. They want the Treasury to issue fiat money and pay all the government's bills with fiat money that way. Their lure that they always offer is two parts. They offer two lures. They offer one, they have this weird obsession with a hate towards interest rates. So one of their lures is that you would outlaw interest rates and you would have zero interest loans. And, you know, that just goes down so many, there's so many fallacies involved there. And then the other lure that they use is that if the government could just print however much money it needs to stay in business, then they wouldn't need to tax you. Now, this is like punching someone in the nose with your right fist and telling them that you're a peaceful person because you're holding up your left hand openly and you're saying, look at my left hand, I'm a peaceful person, I'm not hurting anybody with my left hand. Well, you're punching them in the nose with your right hand. If you are printing fiat money in mass to pay the government's bills, then what you're doing is devaluing the money every time you print more money. So anybody who has money, when you print money, that money is devalued. Let's say I have $100 and the government prints a bunch of money. The buying power of my $100 just goes down right when that happens. As soon as the money that the government printed gets into circulation, the value of the money I'm holding goes down. So that's inflation. Inflation, like a balloon, inflates. That's the supply of money increasing without wealth to go with it. It's just empty. It's full of hot air. And that's what inflation is. It's the quantity of money growing without the value of the without the a value to back it up. That's what fiat money is. Fiat being faith-based, meaning the word itself indicating very much like the word amen. It's a word indicating that you believe it to be so. So fiat money is based on the belief that it has value. But the more of it you print, the less value it is. So if you're taking the value of the money away from people as you print it, it's a tax. It's the same as a tax. The only difference is it's not out in the open. You can't see it. So any tax that you can't see is far more dangerous than a tax you can see. If you have to actually take money out of your pocket and hand it to a tax collector, then you feel it. You know it happened. You see it happen. But when money is devalued through inflation, through fiat printing of money, it takes place silently and it takes place invisibly. And you can't see it. You can't control it. You don't know when it's happening. So taxing the people through inflation is a far more hideous way of taxing them than openly robbing taxes from them by a guy going door to door with a gun. That would be better. That would be more honest of the government if they actually sent troops door to door with guns and pointed them at you and made you pay your yearly taxes. That at least would be honest. At least they'd be upfront with what they're doing. But when they tax through inflation, it's an invisible tax that most people don't even see. Most people don't understand that it's happening. And that's what the greenbackers want. They want to give governments the ability to just print as much money as they want to pay all their bills with. Well, if you give somebody who has no discipline in their life anyway, like a politician, the ability to have unlimited funding, all they have to do is print more of it. Do you really think that's a good idea? Well, that's the greenbacker plan, scheme, I should say. And it has happened over and over in history. And every time it happens, inflation runs wild and the economy is destroyed. So, and the greenbackers will absolutely lie. This is where the part that really upsets me is when you get into these, especially these movies like The Secret of Oz, and I can't remember the other big greenbacker movie that they made. But when you start to watch these movies that they made, they absolutely lie. Bold-faced lies, stuff that's easy to check out, and they just lie. They don't care. And that's, the hallmark of a scammer is that he has no problem at all lying to you. And that's what the greenbackers will do. So I find it highly unlikely that Ron Paul Well, no, I find it impossible that Ron Paul has the level of knowledge of Austrian economics that he has, and could still honestly be a greenbacker. The two are just incompatible with one another. You know, greenback as I mentioned in the last podcast, the government controlling the money supply, that's the essence of socialism. The money supply is the primary means of production in a society. So if the government controls the means of production, if they control the quantity of money and the quality of money and all these things, then you have socialism. When the government controls the means of production, money being a primary means of production, you have socialism. So the greenbackers are socialists. And if Ron Paul is, you know, toying with them for their support, then I think that's morally wrong. If Ron Paul is doing it out of ignorance, then Ron Paul needs to realize the flaw of what he's doing. And he needs to clarify the difference between what he's saying that he wants to do, you know, with the money supply, which, as far as what I've heard, he wants an open market in money, where the market itself decides what money is and how much money there that is in circulation. But one way or the other, he should clarify this, and he should not be leading on the greenbackers, nor deceiving people to make them think he's a greenbacker. He should be very out front and clear about this. But I haven't seen that yet. I would love to see that. I would love to see Ron Paul clarify his position on this. Talking about Gary North for a few days here on the podcasts, I'd like to see Gary North confront him on it. And you know, they know each other. They have, I don't know what kind of level of friendship they have currently, but they've worked together many times throughout the years. So I would just love to see Gary North clarify this point with Ron Paul, because Gary North is probably the most knowledgeable person out there on debunking the greenbackers. Okay, so let's see if we can wander away from that topic for a little while. I'm sure I'll have to come back to the greenbacker topic again at some point in time, but it really wears me down. I really get very frustrated with the greenbacker, with the whole thing. You know, so many honest people have been confused by these greenbackers that it's really upsetting, and it's really upsetting that they use the fight against the Federal Reserve as an opportunity for them to push their socialist agenda. So anyway, so let's shift away from that, shall we? Let's go to something a little less controversial than Ron Paul and greenbackers. The Bilderberger people are going to be meeting in Virginia this year. And this is not foil hat stuff. The Bilderberger meetings take place. It's not a secret anymore. We know that this happens. There's plenty of documentation. They used to keep these things a secret. They don't anymore. In 2008, the Bilderbergers met in Virginia, and for one afternoon, Hillary Clinton's campaign for presidency and Barack Obama's campaign for presidency, for one afternoon, both of those campaigns paused as both Hillary and Barack Obama together went and met with the Bilderberger group. And when they came out, it was only like the next day or something that Hillary, even though her campaign was going well, she suspended her campaign. And the die was cast. I mean, you know, now, again, this is not foil hat stuff. Everything that I just said is well documented and easy to look up. You can make up anything you want to fill in the blanks of what happened when Hillary and Barack Obama went and met with the people of the Bilderberger group. You can make up anything you want to go in to fill in that gap. We don't know what happened because nothing is recorded, and the people who were in the meetings, those people don't talk. So if you want to speculate on what took place in that meeting, then you're wandering into the foil hat area. But if you just stick with the facts and realize that that both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama together stopped what they were doing, cleared their schedule, and went and met with the Bilderberger group. And then immediately after that, Hillary suspended her campaign. If you just look at those facts, then it's not hard to come to a conclusion that that a choice was made and a decision was made and orders were given and people followed those orders. Now, what will happen this year in Virginia when the Bilderberger group meets? Well, who knows? Who knows? Will Mitt Romney get their blessing? Will Barack Obama get their blessing? Will Hillary get a second chance? Who knows? That's anybody's guess. I have a tendency to think Barack Obama is right where they want him, and I have a tendency to think Barack Obama is right where the Republicans want him, because as the economy continues to be unstable, it's in the Republicans' interest to not win the presidency. I've been saying this for well over a year now, that the Republicans don't really want the presidency in 2012. They would rather Barack Obama ride through what's about to hit us so that they can blame the Democrats and come into a better position, taking control of both houses of Congress and the presidency in 2016. I've said that for a long time now. That's been the Republicans' plan for a while. So that again, I'm saying it publicly, that's what I expect to happen. I expect Obama to win again, and I expect him to beat Mitt Romney, and I expect the economy to temporarily look better. But then at some point, what I was talking about the other day, the bubble in the commercial market has to pop. And when it does, we're going to see the same things that's going on in Greece and Spain and so forth. We're going to start to see that here. And I'm not talking so much about the riots, although there's going to be riots in the big cities. I'm talking about the financial collapse that's hitting the European markets right now. That's going to come here when the bubble in commercial property finally pops. And I don't know when that's going to be. I do know this, though. This is a wonderful, here's the disclaimer, I don't give financial advice, I'm not an attorney, I'm not an investor, whatever. But I know this, I am buying silver as much as I can afford and as often as I can afford it, because what I'm seeing that's going to happen is I'm not sure true hyperinflation is going to take place where you have 50% per month inflation or something like that. I'm not sure that's going to happen in that sense. Although, at some point it will have to happen because that's what fiat money does. But there will definitely be a devaluing of the dollar in the next few years. And when that happens, prices of precious metals go up. And gold is a lot more expensive than silver, so I'm buying silver. And I have been buying silver. And right now, when the market is sumped, I am definitely buying silver. Okay, well, that runs, that wipes out the rest of our time. So I just want to get back and tell you the thing that I say at the end of every podcast. I really appreciate you listening. I really appreciate the emails. You can send your emails to Ben, B-E-N, at badquaker.com, BADQUAKER.com. And for more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. Thank you very much, folks, for listening. Goodbye. Okay, well, one more thing. I've already signed off on the podcast and everything and finished it and was in the editing process when some events have taken place and stuff has changed. And so I can right now officially announce that badquaker.com will be sending four people to Porkfest, four of our staff, including Kai and including myself. Now, of course, I can't tell the future because I don't have control of time and space, but we're going to make every effort to make it there. We've reserved a spot at the campgrounds. We'll be in site number 82. If all goes well, we'll be there I'll be there. I'm planning on being there a couple days before Porkfest, and hopefully I'll be able to stay all the way through until the end. And Kai will probably be there from Monday through Sunday as well. So if you're part of the New Hampshire folks that are up there, if you're going to be at Porkfest, stop by at site number 82 and say hi to me. You'll see my motorhome right there, and we're going to try to get a sign that says badquaker.com so that you can tell which one we are. And I'll be milling around. I'll be the old gray fat guy with long hair and a big beard. Well, there could be quite a few people like that at Porkfest, but I'll be the one who's me. I'll be me. So if you're there, come say hi. Okay, thanks a lot, folks. Goodbye.